Father God, we thank you for this time this morning together as your people. We thank you for this period of history when many of the foundations for the intellectual system that we so pride ourselves on in the West was taking root. There are things there to see that are positive and things that are negative. And just help us to sort through these things and have discernment. Help us to be encouraged and discerning as we look at the history that unfolds before us as you have preserved it for our eyes and that we might benefit from these things. In Christ's name we pray, amen. All right, a quick review this morning. We saw last time the 12th and 13th centuries saw a great flowering of knowledge, especially theology and philosophy in Western Christendom. And at the heart of this flowering knowledge was the rise of the university. Universities are something we take for granted in our day. They're all around the world. They're the institutions of higher learning. Where did they come from? And we're actually looking at how universities and the system of universities around the world developed. The institution of a university came to the West from where? A rather unexpected source.
The Muslims.
At this time, the Muslims were kind of at their high watermark in terms of intellectual, scientific, civilized development. And in some ways, the Christian West was a kind of a low ebb, and not quite there yet, but interesting things going on. The last place I would have expected this to come from would have been the Muslims, but there it is. What was the normal age that a man would enter the university in the Middle Ages?
16?
Yeah, around 14 or 15. What language was spoken in all universities in the Middle Ages?
Latin.
So if you spoke Latin, you could go to a university anywhere in the world and you could understand the instruction. The scholastic theologians were deeply concerned about the relationship between faith and reason. We looked at this last week. They wanted to see how far pure reason could discover or prove the doctrines of the Christian faith. And we're going to see the outworking of this even in our material today. We kind of introduced it last week. Give some of the examples that I provided last week of the kind of questions that schoolmen spent exploring in the Middle Ages that we would consider pointless in our day. You remember some of those examples I threw out there? Those crazy examples.
God can't die, but God died.
That was actually an example he did give us in the lesson. So that's, yeah, we talked about that.
Oh, okay.
No, that's fine. We did. That was an example. Yeah, yeah, you know, and the way I often hear it explained is, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin idea. So that was one. It's the idea of the spatial qualities of angels.
Oh, yeah, or can two angels be in one place at the same time?
Yeah, yeah, and then can one angel be in two places at the same time? That was another one. It's kind of the opposite of it. There was
They have a similar one about demons or something?
I don't remember that one, but here's one that was one of my favorite. Could God become incarnate as an animal or a woman? They would explore that. He came as a man, but could he have been an animal? Could he have been a woman? Oh my. And we look at the ones about the angels. And then who sinned most, Adam or Eve? I guess we're still arguing about that, right? Anyways. So today we're going to look at philosophy and the writings of Aristotle. So besides being theologians, the schoolmen were also the philosophers of the Middle Ages. They wanted to give a comprehensive account, not just of church teaching, but of all truth. They wanted to know everything. They wanted to know all about life. They wanted to know much beyond. They didn't just limit themselves to theological questions. They would try to answer deep philosophical questions. For example, they would want to know, what is matter, really? Not what is the matter, but what is matter? what is mind? You know, we are conscious of our own mind, but what is that? what is that, that, that mind, that consciousness that we have as we're thinking about things and perceiving things. What is time, really? I mean, we track time, but what is it? What is space? Again, these almost seem like obvious questions when you start exploring the theological depths of some of these issues. It gets rather mind-boggling. What is being? What does it mean to be a being? What's the nature of cause and effect? And this leads to discussions, for example, of the ultimate cause, the proof for the existence of God. We're gonna get there, not even this week, but that's coming. In the 13th century, scholastic theology came to rely increasingly on the philosophy of Aristotle. And this is intriguing, because remember, Aristotle is like, what, 4th century B.C.? This is not like a contemporary figure. You have the three biggies. You have Socrates, and then his student Plato, who we don't have anything from Socrates other than what Plato gave us. Then you have Plato and his Republic and all his writings. Plato was a huge influence up to this time. And then his student was Aristotle. And these are all 4th and 5th century B.C. thinkers. They're just basically pagan Greek thinkers who weren't Christians. And yet they had a profound influence on Christianity. So now we're going to see the influence of Aristotle. Up till now, the heaviest influence has been Plato. We talked about him way back. And this has been so long ago, many of you may be a little fuzzy in your memory. Way back when we were looking at around the 2nd century, some of the early church fathers were heavily influenced by Greek philosophy, and particularly Plato. And Plato has an influence that kind of weaves throughout church history. Even Augustine is thought to have been a follower of Plato's ideas in many areas. So there's a lot of influence of Greek philosophers. But now we're seeing Aristotle come to the fore. And you kind of got to ask, why? Aristotle was one of the greatest of the ancient pagan philosophers of Greece. A few of Aristotle's works have been known to early schoolmen because there was a guy in the 6th century who translated them into Latin. Again, these guys speak Latin. They can't go back and read Aristotle in the original Greek. So if they're going to read him, they have to have a translation. There was a small amount of his work was translated and available, but not much. However, almost all of Aristotle's writings became available in Latin in the 1100s, largely through two great Muslim philosophers. So the Muslims got interested in Aristotle, which this is crazy too. You got this really big mix of this, you know, pagan Greek thought with Muslim thinking and philosophy, and fascinating how knowledge sort of unfolded during this period. So you have these two philosophers. There was a Persian, and there was a Spanish guy, Averroes. And they translated Aristotle from Greek into Arabic for the benefit of the Islamic world. And then there were Christian scholars, such as Michael Scotus, who then translated the Arabic along with Islamic commentaries on Aristotle. So they actually had, like we have commentaries on the Bible. They had commentaries on Aristotle. The Muslims did. And so you've got some guys who are, they can't read Greek, but apparently he can read Arabic, and he translates the Arabic translation into Latin for the benefit of the Western Catholic world. Now later, scholars did translate Aristotle into Latin directly from the original Greek, which you would expect would be the best. I mean, it's just like Bible translations, you know. If you can go to the source, go to the original, and translate from there, you're going to get a more accurate translation. But the rediscovery of Aristotle by Western Europe had a huge impact on Western thought. We cannot underestimate the influence and impact that Aristotle had on Western thinking. In fact, I think my son said that he was in a college, Jason said that he was in a college class, I don't know if it was a philosophy class or whatever. And the professor got up and said, whether you know it or not, you are all Aristotelians. He said, and a lot of you don't even know who Aristotle is, hardly. He said, but you're all Aristotelians. And what he meant was, you are so Your Western thinking has been so profoundly shaped by Aristotle that you cannot help in some way or manner or fashion be Aristotelian. And Jason found that fascinating when he looked into it a little bit and discovered how much influence Aristotle had. So we can't underestimate this. In the writings of Aristotle, Christian thinkers found an interpretation of God and humanity and the world which seems logical, convincing, and comprehensive. An interpretation that had been worked out without any reference to the Bible. What could go wrong? What could go wrong here? We got it all worked out. It's logical, it's convincing, and we didn't even have to use the Bible. A little bit of a problem on the horizon here. The problem was some of Aristotle's teaching contradicted the teachings of the Bible. For instance, Aristotle taught that the world had always existed. Now, actually, this has found its way into Western thinking. Now, there's, you know, in more recent years, there's been the idea of a Big Bang and an origination of sorts. We would argue about the number of years and so forth, but nevertheless, they've shifted away from a sort of a eternal state of universe that's always been there to a universe that has some kind of beginning. But Aristotle thought the world had always existed. Of course, we know the Bible teaches in the beginning God created. Some Western thinkers were so enthusiastic for Aristotle, especially as he had been interpreted by the Muslim philosopher Averroes, that they accepted and taught even the anti-Christian elements of his thought. They just thought, Aristotle is just such a great guy, man. And they just kind of got so enthusiastic and carried away. Even things that contradicted the Bible, they just rolled right along with it. These men were called Averroes, and their greatest champion was Seeger of Brabant. Seeger taught that the universe had existed from all eternity. It's an Aristotelian idea. And that individual human souls were not immortal, but were absorbed into a world soul after death. This almost sounds pantheistic to me. I haven't studied him extensively, so I don't know if that's true. But again, we're getting away from Scripture. Seeger at first lectured in Paris, but when the church condemned his teachings as heretical in 1276, he fled to Italy. But this did not prove to be much of a safe haven, since Seeger was murdered there by a priest whose enthusiasm for orthodoxy proved stronger than his respect for the Sixth Commandment. I love the way I quoted that directly out of my history book. Good way to put it. Good way to put it. Sixth Commandment obviously being the prohibition against murder. To defend themselves against charges of heresy, some Averroes put forward the theory of double truth. Does this sound familiar? I mean, we don't use this terminology, but people who want to have their cake and eat it too today.
Relativism?
Yeah, and just the idea of, well, this is true, but then this is true. And there's the third way, and, you know, they're always looking for a way to not offend the religious thinkers, but then somehow get their new secular thinking into the mix. So they came up with the idea of double truth. This theory held that human reason by itself would compel philosophers to accept certain things as truth, but then divine revelation showed those things were false and that something else was really the truth. So now we have a double truth. But there's really no double truth, as we all know. There's only one truth. Whatever it is, there's only one truth. You can't have two truths that contradict one another. But that's what they came down to, because they're accepting two authorities. But in reality, as Jesus has taught, you can't serve two masters, really. That you're eventually going to serve one and reject the other. And in this case, so often, it's the Bible that bites the dust and secular thinking to which men bow down. This double truth theory set reason and faith in sharp conflict with one another. Well, welcome to the modern world. I mean, that's where we are today, right? This is we're in the 11, 12, 1300s, and we're still there today. How many years later? It meant that if a person followed reason, he was bound to end up believing some things that contradicted revelation. Again, how many people have this experience or are having this conflict as they go to college and they're being taught certain things about the history of the earth or the history of living things or what have you, and then they look in the Bible and see that that's not what happened. At first, many Catholic theologians reacted against Aristotle and saw his philosophy as dangerous, as a dangerous alternative to Christianity, especially in view of what the Averroists were saying. And you can see why, and you know, you want to almost kind of cheer them on. Up until then, the Western Church had found the philosophy of Plato to be the most suitable ally of Christian theology, especially since Augustine of Hippo, the great Western theologian, had been a Platonist. And it wasn't just Augustine. It goes all the way back to, now you, again, this is a long time ago when we taught these things. You may be fuzzy in your memory on them. But you remember that one of the early church fathers in the second century, Justin Martyr, he did not apparently have access to a lot of the New Testament wherever he was. And he died a martyr. I mean, we can respect him in a lot of ways, but he was heavily influenced by Plato. In fact, he was a follower of Plato before he was a Christian. He's the guy that was walking along the shore of a lake or something like that, and he ran into a Christian, and the guy witnessed to him, and it shook his faith in human reason. And so he became a Christian, and yet apparently didn't completely shake his faith in Christian human reasoning, because he found a way to sort of blend his Plato beliefs with his Christian beliefs. But then you had other early church fathers who saw the danger of this. Tertullian, one of my favorite early church fathers in the second century, third century era. And you remember Tertullian had a famous quote. Does anybody remember what it was, where he was sort of condemning Greek philosophy? It's a real well-known. It's one of, he had a lot of famous quotes. This is a long, long time ago, so if you don't remember, I'm not blaming you, but stop, somebody might remember. What has Jerusalem to do with Athens? Remember that? What has Jerusalem to do with Athens? In other words, Jerusalem, the seat of divine revelation and Jewish thought, which is what Christianity grew out of, versus Athens, which is the seat of Greek philosophy and Gentile knowledge. And he said, what do these two have to do with each other? It's a rhetorical question with an answer demanded, which is nothing. why be influenced by all this crazy Greek philosophy? So this has been going on for a long time, really. But Plato, for whatever reason, the second of the two, of the three, of the great three, seemed to be carrying sway for many centuries with many Christian theologians, including Augustine. But now that's beginning to shift to Aristotle. And Aristotle disagreed with some of Plato's basic teaching. Now, again, Aristotle was a student of Plato. He learned from Plato, but then he went on to develop thought and can come up with his own ideas, some of which went contrary to Plato's thinking. For example, Plato held that the human soul had a direct inner knowledge of a higher spiritual world, and that this knowledge did not depend on our experience of life in the outward physical world. You may, again, we covered this a long time ago, and you may be fuzzy on it, or maybe you remember it from your Western Civ classes, whatever, but Plato had this kind of view that the physical world we live in was kind of a shadow of some eternal reality. And everything in this physical world was sort of an imperfect reflection of this eternal real world out there. And our souls within us were eternal. And we had a sense of those eternal things, including things like God, within ourselves. So that was kind of Plato's view. And it didn't depend on outward senses or experience or things you could see. In fact, he would say the things you see are just imperfect shadows of the ultimate eternal realities that are out there. And, of course, Plato went on to teach that we derive our fundamental ideas from such ideas as beauty and justice from this inner knowledge. We have within ourselves a sort of sense of justice and a sense of beauty. And, of course, there's a little bit of truth to Plato's teaching here, because man made in the image of God, God has put within the hearts of man the idea of eternity, the idea of when you look at the world around you, you see there's a creator that screams out to you. God's built us in such a way that we have an internal recognition of eternal reality. So he was onto something here. Aristotle, on the other hand, his student, who took his teaching in a little different direction, Aristotle taught that all human knowledge arose from experience, mediated to the soul through the senses, through what we can see and hear and touch. This, in essence, is secular science today, right? This is secular thinking. If I can't see it, if I can't touch it, if we can't measure it with a microscope, a telescope, whatever, it's not real. It's just fantasy. Who knows? According to Aristotle, we can know that a spiritual being like God exists then only by reasoning from our experience of the external world. The soul cannot have any direct or immediate spiritual knowledge of God. Thus you have, and we're going to see this as we unfold some of the great schoolmen of this time period, a lot of proofs for the existence of God based on the things that we see in the world around us. Many traditional Catholic theologians preferred Plato to Aristotle, and they led a campaign to ban the study of Aristotle's writings. And for a time, they enjoyed a measure of success. However, by the 13th century, the tide had turned in Aristotle's favor. And scholastic theologians were hailing him as the great pagan forerunner of Christian truth. In fact, I think it was one of the, I think it was Clement of Alexandria, if I recall, who said that, what did he say? I think as the Jews were to Christianity, so the Greek philosophers were to the Christians. It's like the Greek philosophers were sort of a forerunner to our knowledge. I'm sorry, I thought I could remember it, but my brain went fuzzy on me. Anyways, it's the idea of these philosophers were forerunners of the great truths that we now enjoy, and they wanted to incorporate them into our thinking as Christians. The schoolmen now sought to bring together Aristotle's philosophy and Christian theology into a harmonious unity, much as today's theologians often try to marry theology to the latest scientific theory about the origin of the universe or humankind or the way people work. And we see this, right? You see people who, they will take evolutionary theories and say, well, yeah, I think the Bible teaches that. And you go, it does? You might read Genesis again. And, well, yeah, I mean, it's some, you know, and they find ways to twist the divine revelation so that it matches modern scientific thought. And it happens in all kinds of areas, even areas like counseling. You know, and you go, a lot of modern counseling is based on Freudian type thinking, not all of it, but and more secular type thinking. And then there is an idea in the Bible of counseling one another and things like that, and that they try to marry the two and blend them in ways that end up distorting. Again, it seems like when they try to start marrying the two systems, it's the Bible that gets thrown out the window and the secular idol remains in its place. Thus, we have it going on here, all the way back then. The theological upheavals Aristotle caused in Western Catholic world had no parallel in the Orthodox East, where the knowledge of Aristotle had never been lost. I thought this was fascinating, just a sort of an afterthought in the history book I was reading. This is all going on in the West. Aristotle is being translated for the first time into Latin, and everybody's reading going, wow, look at this stuff. Where's this stuff been? This is so cool. And the people in the East are like, we've been reading Aristotle for years in the Greek. That's what it was written in, and this is nothing new. We're not really excited about this. The Greek in which Aristotle wrote did not need to be translated for the Byzantine theologians, the Eastern theologians, as it was their own native language. Therefore, there was no revival of Aristotelian philosophy in the East, no sudden Aristotelian challenge to throw Orthodox theology off balance, and no real Eastern equivalent of Western scholasticism. The Eastern theologians just weren't impressed. It's amazing to me how often the Eastern theologians really seem to get it right. I mean, you know, not that I'm totally on board with all of Eastern thought, but in things like this, it's just kind of, they weren't knocked off off balance by this. So now we're going to, as an outgrowth of what we've been talking about, we're going to look at what are considered the great scholastic theologians. There's a number of them. I won't cover every single person who could be considered a great scholastic theologian, but I'll try to cover the big names. We'll probably be on this for maybe another week or so. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But we're going to start with, this week, One of the big names, Anselm of Canterbury. I think everybody's heard of Anselm, even if you don't know what he taught or what he thought. When I start explaining some of his thinking, some of you will be going, eh, I have heard that. Not necessarily in this class, just out there. So Anselm was born in northern Italy. He became a monk in the French Benedictine Abbey of Lebec in Normandy. And he was elected as abbot in 1078. And in 1093, he became Archbishop of Canterbury, which is in England. So he got around a little bit. He was born in northern Italy, moved was a monk in France, and then he ends up being sent to Canterbury. I didn't get into it here, but there was a lot of history there about he really didn't like being pushed. This is like sort of a political role, and there was a lot of battles going on. You remember we talked about some of this in earlier classes between the rulers and the popes. And the churches, you know, the religious authorities and the secular authorities or the governmental authorities were battling. Who has control? Who has the power? And to be in a position like this in Canterbury, put a guy like Anselm right in the middle of that stuff, and he hated it. He did not enjoy being involved in that. But he got pushed into it anyways. But he was himself one of the greatest saints of Western medieval church, a man of spotless life, unflinching devotion to the truth and righteousness, and a profound reverence and burning love for Christ. And you're like, wow, really? Anselm's most important writings for the development of scholastic theology were his Monologion, and Proslogion, which tried to prove the existence of God by pure reason. So now we're beginning to get into the proof for the existence of God. He's one of the guys who attempted this. So these two writings laid out those ideas. Then he had another writing called Curdeus Homo, which offered the first systematic theology of the atonement. Now, I'm quoting the history writer. I have shown you earlier, we went back, and this has been several weeks ago, we looked at development of the idea of the atonement in Christian history. And people saying that, you know, we didn't even have a really systematic theology of the atonement until Anselm. That's not quite right, okay? I mean, yes, he probably created the first formal systematic theology. Maybe you could think of it that way. But there are many writings. I mean, to understand the atonement is needed for salvation. So you have no Christians if you have no atonement. But understand the thinking here may have to do with the systematic and the systematizing of it and the way he lays it out. So first we'll look at his proof for the existence of God. Now this is one of the things that he's most famous for. And of all the proofs for existence of God, we've all probably heard them somewhere along the line, especially the idea of first cause or the proof from design and so forth. We've heard a lot of these proofs. But of all the proofs for the existence of God, this is the weirdest, most bizarre, in my opinion, proof for the existence of God I've ever seen. I'm just going to tell you up front, even though I believe in the existence of God, of course, I do not find this proof persuasive. In fact, most people find it gives them a headache to even try to understand it. Now, I'm going to summarize it for you real quickly here, and I can explain a little bit more if I need to. I've listened to long lectures on this proof. And okay, here goes. Here's this proof. By definition, God is the most perfect of all possible beings. So he starts with that as a premise, and you can kind of go, okay, I'm with you so far. No problem. Okay? Hang on. Buckle your seatbelt. But if God does not exist, he would not be the most perfect of all possible beings. For a God who does not exist would be more perfect than a God who does not exist. Now this is where it starts to get a little bit, okay. But the assumption here is that something that exists is obviously more perfect than something that doesn't exist. I mean, how can you be perfect at all if you don't exist? But anyhow, so he says, so if God does not exist, then he would not be the most perfect of all possible things, which is the definition of God, as we accepted in the first premise. Therefore, If God is, by definition, the most perfect of all possible things, he must exist. Otherwise, he wouldn't be as good, at, you know, as the God who does exist, which might not exist. See, this is where you start to get the headache. I'm trying to follow this. Anyway, theologians and philosophers have argued for thousands of years about whether Anselm's proof is valid. You can decide for yourself. I would not use this in a discussion with an unbeliever or anybody else personally. Even though I agree with his premise and I agree with his conclusion, somewhere in the murky middle, I'm not quite sure I'm on board. That's just me. Some people have found it to be profound. Maybe it is. So that's his proof for the existence of God, the ontological view. On the atonement now, Anselm, I love Anselm on the atonement. See what you think. Anselm rejected a view that was widespread amongst the early church fathers that Christ's death was a ransom paid to Satan to free sinners from captivity to him. You know, there are passages talked about Christ's death being a ransom. And so people trying to fill in the gaps, ransom to whom? Some filled in that gap with Satan, that Christ had to buy back the lost sinners from Satan in order to win them back to God. I have a little bit of difficulty with that. Anselm rejected that. And I'm kind of like, I like Anselm on that. Here's Anselm's argument. He says, Satan has no rights over the human race. He's a robber and an outlaw who has taken us captive unjustly. Christ's death was paid as a ransom, not to Satan, but to God. I like that. I like that much better. He develops this. He says, human sin has outraged God's honor and majesty. Good. The human race must either suffer punishment or offer compensation, satisfaction to God for the outrage. We've outraged God by our sin. God's outrage must be satisfied. His wrath must be satisfied in order, either that or we have to suffer punishment for the outrage that we have created in God. So far, so good, I think. But we cannot offer any satisfaction for so great an outrage. Sin is infinitely serious, so a just satisfaction to God would have to be infinite in value, and that's something human beings cannot produce. Only God could offer himself such an infinite satisfaction. However, because the Trinity is merciful as well as just and willed to save sinners, God the Son became human in Jesus Christ, and Christ the God-man on humanity's behalf offered to God the Father an infinite satisfaction for the outrage of sin. I like that, I think. That satisfaction was the God-man's own infinitely valuable life. Because he was without sin, Christ did not have to die, but he freely surrendered his life to the Father on the cross. God then rewarded Christ for his voluntary self-sacrifice by applying the infinite worth or merit of his death to, catch this, to the elect, those sinners predestined to salvation by divine grace. Do we see what we would call today Calvinism here? In the Middle Ages, by a bishop of Canterbury in the Catholic Church? I mean, just about the time you think the gospel's been lost, you come across something like it. Well, okay. Wow. Now, he was Augustinian in his, you know, that some of the different philosophers and thinkers of the day tended to follow earlier thinkers. And those who follow Augustine tend to be more what we would describe as Calvinistic. You understand the term Calvinistic. Obviously, Calvin lived for many years later, and we're sort of applying the term earlier. Just, it's a theological category and a term that we use. That's why I use it. obviously, way precedes Calvin. Anyways, God rewarded Christ by applying the infinite merit of his death to the elect. I thought that was encouraging to find this. You know, when we saw Gottschalk here a couple of weeks ago, another Calvinist. So they're still around. It's not like Calvin was the first Calvinist by any means. I mean, obviously, I would say Paul was, you know, or before all of them, but even if you leave out the New Testament writers, just in church history, It's not like Calvinists disappeared off the face of the earth until the Reformation. There were signs of life throughout the church history. Anselm's doctrine of the atonement contained many fruitful ideas which later theologians built into the classic Western understanding of Christ's death. I only wish they had done it more so. The Catholics really went astray from some of his Calvinistic thinking. Anselm's argument shows us the mind of a scholastic theologian at work. He's not content simply to believe that Christ died for sinners. He wants to know why Christ had to die for sinners. He wants to get into the details. He wants to understand how it all works. That's the classic mark of a scholastic thinker, and I think a classic mark of a good Berean Christian, honestly. Anselm's motto was Credo ut intelligam. I believe so that I may know. Now we are going next week, we won't have time this week because we're going to run out of time today, but next week we're going to look at Peter Abelard, who has the opposite philosophy and the opposite motto. He rejects this motto. His motto is, I know so that I may believe. Okay? So you got to think about, what does this mean? I believe so that I may know. What he's telling us is that belief and acknowledgement of God and God's categories are foundational to human knowledge. If you don't begin by believing in divine revelation and accepting those as your foundation, then you can't really know anything. That's what he's saying. I know only because I believe. You could kind of flip the motto around a little bit. I think that's what he's getting at. I believe so that I may know. But if I don't believe to begin with, and really, honestly, everybody has to believe something before they can begin to know anything. Your whole system is built on some foundational belief. So I think he's onto it here. Abelard flips that on his head. I know so that I may believe. I first have to explore and satisfy myself that I know certain things, and then I can believe. So we're gonna see how that goes. Very, very interesting juxtapositioning of some ideas. Again, these ideas are part of the big battle that's raging all around us today in the universities, in the media, in the streets, as we talk with people and so forth. This is very, very up to date. As they sometimes say, the ink still smears on this stuff. It's like it's just been printed. still hot. So we'll look next week at Peter Abelard, a huge influence, and not necessarily an all bad person, but we're going to see a contrast between him and Anselm on the motto, among some other things. Very popular guy. So look forward to that. We'll be eventually getting into some of the big names like Aquinas. Everybody's heard of Aquinas. And we'll be looking at others probably next week. So stay tuned. Thank you for the snack. Those cinnamon rolls are absolutely delicious. any volunteer for next week? Okay. Crystal? Thank you. Class discussion time. Boy, it was hard to pick this week. So many things that we've thrown out there. So here's some possibilities. Aristotle taught that all human knowledge arose from experience mediated to the soul through the senses, through what we can see, hear, and touch. There are some questions for you on that. Do you agree with this? I got these out of order. That's nice. Is there a place for this kind of approach to understand? Okay. Do you agree with this? Is there a place for this kind of approach to understanding reality? No, you know, I'm going to anticipate that a lot of us would just say, no, that's not how we get to know all truth. But is there a place for this kind of approach to understanding reality? Is there something to this? The idea of what you can see, what you can measure, what you can touch. What are the limitations to this kind of approach to understanding reality? Maybe we could ask it that way. So there's some thoughts we could play with on that. Then I ask, do you find Anselm's? Boy, I did a good job on that. I must have been half asleep when I typed this. Do you find Anselm's ontological proof of the existence of God persuasive? And I ask, what do you think of Anselm's explanation of Christ's atonement? I almost started to try to reproduce it here, but it was too long and complicated. I had to have two more slides, so I decided I would have given that. You kind of have to remember it. I'll go back over if you want me to. And, of course, as always, you can ask your own question if you've find something even more interesting than what I've thrown up there on the board so far. So, anybody want to try to tackle one of these or several of these? Or I left us some extra time this morning on this because I don't want to, by the time I get into somebody new, I would have used up all our time, and this gives us about 10 minutes to talk about it. So we got some time.
I think on the ontological argument, based on what I understand from this, I would not agree with him, or I would not choose to use that method. So the logic here is basically saying that God exists based on the definition that we have of God.
Right.
Which means that that would be true, that a God exists, but not necessarily the God, and gives us no way of knowing that God, or if that God has any desire to know us.
Yeah, that's true.
It just says that the most perfect being in existence is God, which could mean there's more than one God, and it changes over time because the most perfect being changes from time to time depending on who's alive at the time.
Those are some good thoughts.
It doesn't really lead us to the truth of the true God, so I would have to reject that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, good thoughts on that. Yeah, I mean, all the best you prove from that is that the most perfect of all beings exist. But what does that even mean?
Exactly. And that just comes to me not to prove that there is God as we understand him, but that this definition of God exists. Sure, you cannot make that argument and be right.
Yeah.
I agree. The ontological argument is a little muddy. however, first of all, I don't use it as a persuasive argument
sure.
to make any progress on an apologetic base. The idea that the greatest conceivable being proves the existence of the greatest conceivable being. I don't know if he classified it as ontological. C.S. Lewis built on the concept of the fact that we hunger proves the existence of something to feed that hunger, proves the existence of food. The fact that we thirst proves the existence of something to quench the thirst. The desire for God, mm-hmm. desire for the greatest conceivable being,
yeah.
is itself a proof that there's something to meet that need. Now, someone could come back and say, well, yeah, but what if I desire for a unicorn to exist? That doesn't mean that a unicorn exists, which would go back to the ontological argument of we're only talking about the greatest conceivable being. A unicorn isn't God.
Okay.
And so the thought of God warrants the need for God, which warrants the existence of God. Now, I can see how confusing that is, and we're limited by words to be able to explain the thought. But for some, the ontological argument hasn't been very persuasive. But I think in a general conversation, we can just put that one on the back burner and not use it.
Yeah, that almost sounds a little bit like a second cousin to the ontological argument, because you're bringing in human desire and so forth, which I don't think Anselm incorporated that as part of his proof.
No, he did not.
C.S. Lewis may have been building on mm-hmm. some of Anselm's idea, which we all do. We tend to build on the shoulders of people ahead of us, but all those proofs, we'll get more into them, especially when we get to Aquinas is a classic guy for proofs of the existence of God, and we'll just discuss the whole idea of proving the existence of God. How helpful is it? How persuasive is it? There are people like, and we'll talk about this when we get there more, but R.C. Sproul thought that Aquinas hung the moon, and I think the world of R.C. Sproul, I thought the world, he's no longer around, but I love Sproul. Don't agree with him on everything. He's a Presbyterian, after all, but I loved him on a lot of things. I listened to, he did a series on church history or philosophy or something. He was going through history, and when he got to Aquinas, it was like, what? He was so excited about Aquinas. I said, we're talking about a Catholic guy here. You really? You know, I was just amazed, but Sproul thought he was great.
I don't think that you can have a knowledge of God by reason alone. You can't. But Romans 1, you know, points to the creation as leading to the secular world being without excuse, the lost world being without excuse. So there's something in the existence of creation that proves the existence of a creator, which is the cosmological argument. Or the fact that the universe is intelligently designed requires an intelligent designer to design it. So these can be useful and helpful, mm-hmm. but they all fall short of the special revelation that's required for God to step into that creation and make himself known.
Yeah. And there's so much you don't know about God. I mean, these proofs get you to a certain point, the greatest possible being, or the God who created all things, or whatever. But what else? You know, is he a person like Roger asked? You know, does that mean he's interested in us? Does that mean that he's the only one that somebody doesn't come along? You know, there's so many things you don't know from those proofs. I don't necessarily. Well, we'll discuss it when we get to Aquinas.
One that hasn't been mentioned. I don't know if Aquinas tackles it, but the moral argument I find
yes.
helpful.
Yeah.
Because even though people point to the problem of evil as a possible evidence that God doesn't exist, if God existed, why could there be so much evil in the world? Well, they're borrowing a category
yeah.
of evil that requires a perfect lawgiver to say what is right and wrong.
Yeah.
So the fact of morality proves God's consciousness,
yeah.
I think, is a great one that we could look at. But again, all these things only get you so far as maybe arguing God's existence. It doesn't get you to the atonement, which is, I'm glad how do you pronounce his name? Anselm.
Mm-hmm.
What an amazing development, our articulation of that. He didn't make that up.
Yeah, no, yeah.
Articulating what the Bible said.
Yeah.
And that's excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, I like when you talk about, they borrow from the Christian worldview. All atheists have to borrow from the Christian worldview. I remember that, was that famous debate with Doug Wilson and who was he debating?
Hitchens.
I think it was Hitchens. And Hitchens raised this question, how could God let the Jews go in and, commit genocide and blah, 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 And he said, to even say that that's immoral has to presume an existence of God who declared what's right and wrong. And he said that his illustration was, he said that atheists like Hitchens like to get in the Christian car and drive it around and smash it into a tree and say, see this stupid car, this dumb thing doesn't even run right, And I thought that was an interesting characterization of what atheists a lot of times are doing. They want to borrow from our system to use it to destroy it. Other thoughts? I noticed that Kennard did sort of address the last idea of the atonement. What did y'all think about his explanation of the atonement? It's detailed, but I think it's spot on. I was impressed.
Your first point that he was combating the idea that God ransomed us from Satan.
Yeah, that was one of the ideas he was rejecting. And he was saying, Satan's a robber. He comes in and presumes to take God's stuff, but he has no rights. And God owes Satan nothing. But what we need to be concerned with is what God being satisfied, because God is outraged at our sin.
Right. And I know there's also two sides of the aisle when it comes to propitiation and expiation.
Yeah.
The thought, what is the cross accomplishing? Well, it's satisfying God's wrath.
Yes.
It's like a lightning rod. A wrath absorber is what it is. But other people don't like the idea that God is angry at us.
Yeah.
Or that in some way the cross was to redeem us from God's anger, not so much Satan's ransom.
Yeah. Yeah, so these ideas still get kicked around. I don't know that the Satan ransom view is quite as popular today as it was at one time, but there's that idea of people having conflict with, like you say, God's wrath. it's almost like a reading of Romans 3 to me, and 4, when you see the laying out of the gospel there by Paul, and God's satisfaction, talks about the satisfying of God's wrath. Other thoughts? Anybody else want to tackle anything else? It's because I'm walking back here. It doesn't mean people in the front can't say something. If you want to say something, Ethan or Martin or whoever, feel free. Don't want to leave anybody out. Nothing? Father, thank you for the time we've had to discuss these ideas, to see in history both things that disturb us but things that encourage us. That's the way the outworking of history always seems to go. We know ultimately we'll all bring you glory in the end. And we want to be those who bring your glory through our obedience, through right thinking, and help us to discern the threads of history as we see them unfolding before us, to understand which things are truly honoring, which things are to be followed, which things are to be rejected, and help us to continue to fight the good fight, recognizing that we can do nothing apart from your Spirit and through your strength. We ask it in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.